From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Progress reports on the Arab Spring. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Turnout was massive for today's elections in Egypt, but protests continue and there's uncertainty about whether the vote will be free and fair. A UN report accuses Syria of crimes against humanity, and the Assad regime calls Arab League sanctions a declaration of economic war. In Yemen, a protest leader has been appointed prime minister. Islamists have won in Morocco. The government of Kuwait has resigned. We'll look at a region where decades of repression have given way to widespread instability. On Reporter's Notebook later on, a powerful House Democrat won't stand for re-election, bringing the total to 17. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Egypt turned out en masse for today's elections, while Syria accused the Arab League of economic warfare. We'll look at the changes wrought by the Arab Spring in those and other countries. On Reporter's Notebook, House Democrats are losing a powerful voice in financial affairs as Barney Frank of Massachusetts says he'll step down. First, this news update, the U.S. and NATO will investigate the airstrike that killed some 24 Pakistanis near the Afghan border this weekend. Pakistan says it was unprovoked, and it closed supply lines to Afghanistan. But Afghan diplomats tell a different story. Alyssa Rubin is in Kabul for the New York Times. Alyssa Rubin, always good to have you on our program. What is it that Afghan diplomats are saying, contrary to what we're hearing from the Pakistanis?
Well, it's actually not Afghan diplomats. It's Western diplomats here in Kabul who have been briefed on it. And I've also heard this from Afghan officials. What they are saying is that a group of joint team of NATO and Afghan soldiers took quite heavy fire as they were presumably patrolling or perhaps in the midst of an operation or preparing for an operation along the Afghan-Pakistani border in Kunar province. And then the fire must have been considerable because they called in close air support. And then the close air support came, which was both fixed wing and helicopters. We believe that's not NATO has not verified that yet, but we've heard that sort of secondhand. And then went over the border and attempted to take out the positions that were firing on the NATO and Afghan force. And what we don't know is how far over the border they went, whether there was an effort to contact the Pakistani military to see who might be there, who they did manage to contact, what was said in those conversations. There's quite a bit not known about publicly anyway, about what led up to the airstrike actually going forward. So that's where we are.
In the meantime, how important is it that Pakistan has closed the supply routes to Afghanistan? They've done that before. Is this likely to go on for a long time? And how much more difficult does it make it for U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan?
Well, I think it all really depends on how long it goes on. As you said, the Pakistanis have closed supply routes before. I believe last year, or certainly last winter, there was a closure that lasted almost 2 weeks. These do have some impact, but they certainly don't have impact right away. By now, the Americans on the NATO bases have done a pretty good job of having stockpiles, so certainly shorter closures they can handle. And they've also shifted a significant portion of their supply lines to the north. So I just was speaking with NATO about this, between 50 and 53% of all supplies now come in through the north from Central Asia. And so those are not affected by this. So they have got some alternatives, but clearly this would be a pinch if it goes on for any significant length of time. And it's meant to send, I think, more than have an impact on the fight, it's meant to send a message to the Americans, to NATO, and to Afghanistan, because after all, this affects Afghanistan as well, about just how upset the Pakistanis are.
This is a bad time for the relationship after the killing of Osama bin Laden and other issues that have occurred between our country and Pakistan. It's also a bad time, as I understand it, between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Well, it's a very tense time, certainly. I mean, I think there's a lot of confusion about what each side wants the relationship to be. Afghanistan has become much more public about its frustration with Pakistan, particularly after the killing of Burhanuddin Rabbani, who was the head of the peace process here in Afghanistan. He was assassinated. It was a very carefully thought through plot, assassination. There was an attack on the U.S. embassy, which actually ended up killing a number of Afghans, and all of that seems to have been planned in Pakistan, and so they're really quite frustrated with their neighbors, and they have not worked out a sort of modus vivendi at all, and so there's almost a dysfunctional relationship between all three of the main players here, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the United States.
All right. And as we know, the Pakistani ambassador has recently been replaced. She has not yet arrived here, but is apparently talking with the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, as a lot of diplomatic activity goes along. Alyssa Rubin, it's always good to have you on our broadcast, and thank you very much for joining us today. She is the Kabul Bureau Chief for The New York Times. In a moment, progress reports on the Arab Spring. On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, and I'll be back with To The Point. Egypt is the biggest, most influential country in the Arab world, and today's elections will have a major impact region-wide. With 40 parties and thousands of candidates for the lower house of parliament, the election itself was already a complex undertaking. Recent protests against the military regime have made the process more uncertain than ever. Let's look first at the turnout with Shadi Hamid. He's normally in Doha, Qatar, for the Brookings Institution. Currently, he is in Cairo. And Shadi Hamid, it's good to have you back on our program.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Indeed. I understand that a lot of people turned out today.
Yeah, it exceeded all expectations. There was a real worry that because of the clashes in Tahrir the past week, people would be afraid to go out. Security wouldn't be guaranteed. But right when I woke up in the morning, I looked outside, and the lines were extremely long, and that continued throughout the day. So that's what we're hearing all throughout the country. Very, very high turnout.
What does that mean in terms of who's likely to win?
Well, there's no doubt about it that Islamists are going to dominate. No one really disagrees that the Brotherhood will come out as the largest bloc in parliament. It's just a question of by how much. Will they win by a bit or a landslide? What will the spread be? So, I mean, I think what we're talking about is a parliament that is very likely to have between 40% to 50% Islamist representation. And that probably means that the day after the official results come out, there's going to be a lot of alarmism in the U.S. So that's perhaps something that people will have to be prepared for. But I think the more important thing is that this parliament is going to be a strong and assertive parliament, because the higher the turnout is, the more the new parliamentarians come and say, we have legitimacy. We have millions upon millions of Egyptians behind us who voted for us. So that's going to be important in the coming phase, where the parliament is going to be in a struggle for power with the ruling military council. So that's the confrontation I think people will have to watch out for.
You mentioned the demonstrations in Tahrir Square, recently reinstated, and also, of course, the military rule, which is increasingly unpopular. Mona El-Tahawi is a syndicated columnist. She's a regular public speaker on Arab and Muslim issues, and she was raised in Egypt. She joined the protesters in Tahrir Square last week. She was then detained by security forces. She's now back in New York, joins us from there. And Mona El-Tahawi, it's good to have you back on our program. Tell us what happened to you.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me on again. I was on the front line of Mohammed Mahmoud Street, which was the scene of clashes between protesters and security forces, when I was beaten brutally by the riot police and sexually assaulted by about four or five of them who surrounded me, who carried out the assault as they were beating me. And then I was dragged to the Ministry of the Interior, where I was held by the ministry itself for about 5 to 6 hours. And then I was handed over to military intelligence for another 5 hours, two of which I was blindfolded. And the pretext for my detention was that they wanted to verify my identity, but it doesn't take 10 to 12 hours to verify identities, obviously. So I think it was a whole host of things. I think that the beating and the sexual assault was basically, the security forces' revenge, basically, on anyone associated with Tahrir. And I was definitely on the side of Tahrir in that one. And I think the detention by the Ministry of the Interior and the military was that they realized somewhere along the way that I was a journalist, and I also told them I was a dual citizen. I hold U.S. citizenship as well as Egyptian. So I think it was it took that long to figure out what to do with me, because they were probably trying to figure out if I was more damaged in custody or outside. And I've taken it upon myself since they released me to use what happened to me to highlight the horrendous levels of abuse and violence that both the military and the security forces in Egypt continue to use against Egyptians. I have access to the media so people can hear my stories, or my story rather, but you know, more than 3,000 people were injured last week, and most of them go unnamed and unheard. And the fact that these horrific levels of violence continue today, 9 months after we got rid of Hosni Mubarak, is a poignant reminder of why we launched this revolution in Egypt. Police brutality and now army brutality, and especially sexual violence. I mean, I was sexually assaulted by riot police, but remember that the military subjected female activists in March to so-called virginity testing, and that the Mubarak regime would use sexual assault against female activists and journalists. So I'm trying to get the word out there to humiliate the military junta in Egypt and to tell them it's time to step aside for civilian rule.
What do you think of what's happened today, the account we just heard from Shadi Hamid about the enormous turnout in the election?
I am happy to hear that so many Egyptians wanted to go out there and take part in the first post-January the 25th elections. I know that for a small group of people who wanted to boycott, these were imperfect elections because of the violence that they took place under, because some prominent activists are in jail, and because the military continue to use military tribunals against civilians. But it warms my heart as an Egyptian to see so many people go out there and not just take part in the voting, but to show that they want to take part in a more legitimate process. These were not perfect elections by any stretch of the imagination. But when I remember the elections that I used to cover as a journalist in Egypt under the Mubarak regime, where only 2% or less of registered Egyptian voters would go out. I mean, back then, Egyptians made it very clear they wanted nothing to do with these sham elections that the Mubarak regime would basically just hold for show, to show their allies in Washington, D.C. and across the world that Egypt was so-called a democratic country. But today, what people are trying to do is recognize, yes, this election was messy, but it's our mess, and the next one hopefully will be even better. And I think it's a reminder to all the other parties out there that aren't Islamists, that don't have the network on the ground that the Islamists do, that it's time to get out there and combine, along with the activism on the street in Tahrir, a political and a cultural and a social activism that together will help our revolution in Egypt succeed.
I'll get back to Mona El-Tahawi and Shadid Hamid as we move along. First, I want to introduce Robert Pastor. He is a director of the Center for Democracy and Election Management at American University in Washington. He's also a senior advisor on conflict resolution in the Middle East to the Carter Center. He started the election monitoring initiatives of the Carter Center 25 years ago, and he's monitored elections in 40 different countries. Robert Pastor, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much, Warren.
We've only heard a bit from Shadi Hamid. We'll we'll go back to him, as I indicated. But there has been very little monitoring, as I understand it, of an official nature in Egypt. What's the significance of that?
I think the Egyptian government and particularly the military have been very suspicious of international observation of the elections. They have only allowed and accredited the Carter Center as witnesses to the observation process, and that was only quite recent. And I think there's some uncertainty about the proper role of observers, even though I understand that today they are allowing other international organizations to witness the elections as well. So I think it's unfortunate that this rule, as many other rules on the elections, have not been organized and finalized a long time ago so that everybody knew exactly what they would do and would have given the international community a chance both to amplify concerns that may be heard from different parties about the state of the electoral process, and hopefully to educate the Egyptian people to what is a very complicated and very confusing election right now. But unfortunately, this did not occur.
What's the difference between a witness and a monitor?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the when the Egyptian military first permitted a witnessing, I think they saw that as a compromise between monitoring and not doing anything. But I think the Carter Center was very clear in saying that it would interpret witnessing as undertaking the kinds of responsibilities they generally do and that all international observers do, which is to have full access to all stages of the electoral process and to be able to report publicly on what they see. So from their perspective, there is not a big distinction. However, the observers have not had enough time, nor has the population, to understand the full rules and to be able to cover the full nation with a number of techniques, not the least of which would be a parallel vote tabulation, a quick count. I don't believe that any is going to be possible for this particular election.
Let me go back to our first guest, Shadi Hamid. What have you seen in the way of observation going on at election centers?
Well, because I'm not licensed to go in, so I haven't actually been inside the polling stations, but I have been around the polling stations to see the lines and talk to people and get a sense of how people are feeling. I mean, generally, there have been reported irregularities and violations on the part of various parties. So, yes, that has happened, but they're not at a systematic level, and people seem to be fairly content across the board with how the elections have been conducted. So I think people are actually surprised. They thought it would be much worse, and it's worked out fairly well. So, I mean, all of that is very positive. It could have been much, much worse.
Do people appear to understand this very complicated ballot?
Balance between...
I'm sorry, the ballot. The thing that...
Ballot, sorry, yes. The ballot, I mean, the electoral system is very complicated. So even for someone like me who studies these sorts of things for a living, it's hard for me, so I can only imagine what the ordinary Egyptian has to go through. It's a convoluted system, and there's an individual list, and there's a PR list that you vote for, so you essentially have to cast several ballots, and there's a lot of choices, and there has been confusion about it. That's why you have people outside the polling stations who have been trying to explain the process. It's not easy, but it seems that despite that, Egyptians were still insistent on going out there and doing their best to find a candidate to support.
Borju Daragahi is also in Cairo. He's a reporter who covers North Africa and the Middle East for the Financial Times. He's joined us often. And Borju Daragahi, it's good to have you back on our program as well.
It's my pleasure.
What have you seen in Cairo, and what can you tell us about the conduct of these elections?
Well, I went a little bit around Cairo, but mostly I was in the rural parts of the country in Fayoum province, which is a very conservative part of the country. I do have the accreditation to go inside polling centers. I did not see any international observers, but I did see plenty of people from the various parties, especially the Islamist parties, inside the polling centers, sort of keeping an eye on things, keeping an eye on the ballots. There was some question as to how the ballot boxes were sealed. Currently, they're sealed with locks. According to international standards, it's better to use tape so that if the seal is broken, people will know. There was a lot of people. There was a lot of people going to vote. There was small allegations of irregularities, accusations that ballots weren't arriving on time, accusations that at certain polling centers, the people conducting the poll would skip out for a couple hours and not allow voting to take place, create little delays and so on. But in general, it was quite an extraordinary day of elections. It should be kind of pointed out that these elections will not only continue tomorrow, but they will actually be held in different cities over the course of the next few months. So we're not going to get any results in terms of these elections for months. And I think that's where you might see some of the problems, not with the actual voting, but with the counting of the votes.
Robert Pastor, back to you with the Carter Center and the Center for Democracy and Election Management at American University. Have you heard anything? Did you hear anything just now from Borju Daragahi that would give you concern about the way the elections are being conducted?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. The real problem is going to happen when people stop voting and are looking for the results, because the count is not going to occur at polling stations. When they do occur at polling stations and domestic monitors are present, they will be able to assure that the count is fair, and they will also have a statement of the results, which they could compare to the final results. Unfortunately, the ballots are going to be moved to a central location under lock and key, and they will be held there for a while before the count occurs. And even then, the exact formula for coming up with the results of the proportional representation lists and the very complicated formula of quotas for different groups, it may very well elicit an outcome, a result, which is very different than the popular vote. And given the suspicions of the different political parties and the intensity of the contest, any irregularities are likely to be interpreted as biased against a particular group. So the problems are most likely to occur after the voting concludes, although there are undoubtedly going to be other problems as well.
Robert Pastor, again, thank you very much for being on our program. Shadi Hamid, thanks to you as well. We have about 20 seconds left, Shadi Hamid. Before we go, anything you'd like to add?
Well, I certainly agree. I mean, the problem is you have all this optimism now, but people aren't going to actually know the results of their vote until sometime in January. So that to me is the big issue and the big concern going forward. I mean, it's a very hot system with three rounds over 5 weeks. It's almost unprecedented.
Again, Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center in Qatar, and also with the Sabahan Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, currently in Cairo. Thank you very much as well. We'll be back with Mona El-Tahawi, with Borju Daragahi, and other guests as well. On Reporter's Notebook, House Democrat Barney Frank says he will not stand for re-election. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the Arab Spring in the Middle East, focusing at the moment on Egypt and the elections there. Borju Daragahi, once again, we just heard, has been in a rural part of Egypt. Our other observer was in Cairo. Our other two observers have been in Cairo. Mona El-Tahawi there last week, but not today. But I want to go back to Borju Daragahi with the Financial Times. You've come from trying to cover what's going on in Syria to cover the elections in Cairo. What's happening in Syria can be seen as part of the what's called the Arab Spring, but it doesn't have anything like the positive aspect of what we're seeing, at least in the conduct of elections in in Egypt. To bring us up to date to what's happening in Syria, the UN today has said that it has a report indicating that crimes against humanity have been committed there.
Well, indeed, investigators have been examining this question as to whether Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime has been involved in crimes against humanity. I'm actually kind of surprised that it came so late, because this has been going on for months. You know, it's a really horrible story, what is happening in Syria. You had like in Tunisia and Egypt and other Arab countries, you had a peaceful popular uprising that was met with just tremendous and horrendous violence by the regime. And this uprising, some say, is now being transformed into an armed insurrection with a potential for a very destabilizing sort of sectarian-motivated civil war in that country. People are quite concerned, but the level of violence is so high, and the sort of potentially destabilizing effects of this phenomenon in Syria is so extreme that the international community is beginning to take notice. You had the Arab League in a very unprecedented move imposing sanctions against Syria because of its human rights violations, and so there's quite a bit of movement taking place on the Syrian issue on the international level.
Syria has accused the Arab League of economic warfare. Is that strong language in that part of the world?
Well, I mean, it is a very strong language, and with it, you know, carries the very ominous threat that Syria will use its potentially considerable assets around the region to try to fight back against those other governments. But on the other hand, you know, he has a good point, you know, because the Syrian economy, to some extent, is dependent on remittances from the Persian Gulf, from other Arab countries, by Syrians living abroad, and by tightening any kind of economic ties between those countries, restricting those economic ties between, for example, the Persian Gulf countries and Syria, it makes it much tougher even for Syria at a time when it's already under tremendous economic strain.
Borju Daragahi again with the Financial Times. Stephen Cook is senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's author of The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square. Stephen Cook, it's good to have you on our program again.
Thanks to be with you.
What we have heard in Egypt so far is not necessarily a reason for a celebration, particularly given what we heard from Mona El-Tahawi and the way that the riot police and the military have been operating. We don't know what the results are going to be. It's apparent, because it will take so long for them to come through, that there could be a lot of jiggling of the numbers in between now and the time that the results are announced. So to what extent is the Arab Spring really bringing democracy to Egypt?
Well, we just don't know quite yet. I think the people are relieved that the process, at least in this first stage of this first round of the first stage of the election, seemed to have gone extremely well, excuse me, especially given the violence that racked central Cairo last week. But as Mona El-Tahawi and others have pointed out, the security forces remain intact, are generally hostile to the revolutionaries in Tahrir Square, and that there is a long time lag between the time that Egyptians are casting their vote today and when they will actually be tabulated, which opens a whole range of possibilities for tampering and fraud.
What about the Muslim Brotherhood? We heard from Shadi Hamid that they apparently will be a successful, most likely the largest bloc in the parliament, whatever the results may be. How important are they, and should the United States, as Shadi Hamid suggested it might, be concerned and alarmed?
Well, I certainly think that the Brotherhood is going to do very well. All throughout this transition period, they have been saying that they will contest anywhere from 30 to 35% of the seats of the parliament. Recent reports indicate, however, that they are actually going for broke and are seeking to contest even more seats. And I think that the accumulation of the Muslim Brotherhood's political power in a free and more democratic and open Egypt is a cause for concern among American policymakers, primarily because The brothers do not share Washington's vision of the region, and no less Washington's interests in the region. All that being said, there's not a lot that the United States can do about it if Washington is going to be true to its word in terms of supporting democratic transitions, free and fair elections, and undoing 60 years of American policy that was focused on good relations with authoritarians that kept legitimate voices like the Muslim Brotherhood out of the legal political arena.
Borju Daragahi, back to you with the Financial Times. How much evidence did you see of the Muslim Brotherhood per se? You said there were Islamists in the polling places in the rural areas where you were. And why is it that the Muslim Brotherhood is as popular as it is?
Well, I think that the Muslim Brotherhood has built an electoral machine, a campaign machine that is unparalleled in Egypt. They have, let me give you just one quick example. I saw on Twitter, on the Muslim Brotherhood's English language Twitter feed, they had a tweet that said, if you're a foreign journalist and you want any contacts or anything, send us an email. And so just for the heck of it, I sent an email, and within 45 minutes, I got a call back from a very nice, well-spoken, speaking perfect English Muslim Brotherhood representative, and he was almost like, you know, hi, I'm Yahya. How may I serve you? How can I help you? And, you know, that's just like one little example. Today at polling stations, outside of the polling stations, they had teams watching over the vote. They had laptop computers tabulating turnout. They have a real serious campaign operation. They have people posted throughout these polling stations that are ready to meet the media, answer any voter questions, and so on. And this is something that no other party is doing, except maybe in very, very limited areas, the Noor Party, which represents an even more extreme faction of the Islamic political spectrum. And they seem to have a very good campaign operation as well, but nothing like the Brotherhood's.
Let me go back to Mona El-Tahawi, whom we heard from in our first segment, syndicated columnist, a public speaker on Arab and Muslim issues. She was in Tahrir Square, was detained, sexually assaulted and beaten last week. She's now back in New York. You've been very supportive of the revolution in Egypt so far. How concerned are you about the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamic forces?
Well, I'm concerned in the sense that I recognize that they have democratized to an extent, but then they still continue to believe things like women can't be president. So, and I also look at the Muslim Brotherhood as really a microcosm, that the movement structure is a microcosm of the state in Egypt, with the supreme guys at the top being kind of the Mubarak of the movement, if you like, and very frustrated younger rank that is trying to get more of a say. And you really saw that happen when the demonstration started in Egypt on January the 25th, and the Brotherhood as a movement refused to take part. But a lot of younger Muslim brothers and sisters joined the revolution from the beginning and basically broke away from that old guard. So that kind of regimented, top-down microcosm of the state concerns me. And the conservatism that they have for decades now espoused, I think it has really changed Egypt. It was met by a conservatism from the Mubarak regime that would often use Islam to fight their Islam. So I think what we need in Egypt is just, again, this greater expansion or an expansion of the space in the middle for other points of view. And this is really where the revolution and those of us who support the revolution must step up. The Brotherhood isn't going to give us that space, just as Mubarak didn't give us that space. Those of us who identify as liberal, progressive, secular, call it whatever you want, must demand a greater space and must be count more. If the Brotherhood had been able to create these networks, then surely the rest of us can as well, even if we didn't have a lot of time in the run-up to these elections. So it concerns me in that they have these slogans, they have kind of this easy access to religion, they wrap themselves around in these religious slogans. But this is a chance now for those of us who identify as liberals and progressives to fight them back and not give in, because what worries me, not just about the Brotherhood, but about the liberals in Egypt, is that they will allow the Brotherhood to basically dictate our agenda and that we'll forever be reacting to them. We must not react to them. If they win 50% of parliament, then the other 50% of parliament will not be Islamist. And it's up to that other 50% of parliament to both challenge them and learn to create coalitions with them that will bring out the politicians and the pragmatists rather than the ideologues in the Muslim Brotherhood.
The Arab Spring is not confined just to the countries we've talked about. Egypt, obviously, Syria, of course, in different, very different ways. There have been some other events today. I want to catch our listeners up on those. Stephen Cook, back to you with the Council on Foreign Relations. In Yemen, the leader of the protest movement has now been appointed prime minister. What's the significance of that?
Well, this is one of the most unexpected but unexpected changes throughout this season of upheaval in the region. For many months, people have been waiting for Ali Abdullah Saleh, the former president of Yemen, to leave. He finally agreed to do so over the course of the last week. People have been fearing an all-out confrontation. Yet the Yemenis seem to be moving towards a more peaceful transition to power. This is something that, again, in this season of the unexpected happening, one of the most unexpected developments. But again, it is early on in Yemen, and Yemen is, unlike Egypt, a country whose political system is hardly intact and whose economy barely exists. So there is clearly a long and difficult road ahead for Yemenis.
So we know what the leader of the protest movement, it's actually a coalition, actually represents, or does he know what he represents at this point?
Well, this was a coalition of groups that were specifically dedicated towards ending the rule of Ali Abdullah Saleh. And, of course, in coalitions like all over the region, there are groups with different kinds of sensitivities to compromise and concession. At this point, people seem to be saying all the right things about a transition in Yemen. But again, this is quite early, and we don't exactly know what Yemen's trajectory is going to be.
What about the election yesterday in Morocco? It's my understanding that an Islamic group won that one. What does that mean?
Well, it didn't win that election. It got the most of votes, about a quarter of the votes in the election cast. This is the an Islamist party that has participated in politics in Morocco for some time. It models itself to some degree along the same lines as Turkey's Justice and Development Party. They go by the same name. And I don't think there is much of a surprise that the party, which goes by the acronym PJD, did as well as it has. The king has been positioning himself as a reformer, and in a more open political environment, the PJD was likely to do as well as it has.
What about Kuwait? The government in Kuwait, as I understand, resigned today.
Well, these are developments that are just extraordinary, one happening after the other after the other. If you remember back a little more than a week, 10 days ago, protesters occupied the parliament in Kuwait, demanding an end to the government and an end to the prime minister. Kuwait is interesting because it is one country in the region that has, I don't want to go too far here, but that has been relatively more democratic than others, a more active opposition movement that has sought to and succeeded at times in holding the government and the ruling family accountable. But again, this is clearly a region that is in upheaval, wants to over people in the region, want to turn over the old order. They want to live in more democratic, just societies. It is absolutely exhilarating to watch what's happening, and it's going to be fascinating to see how it all turns out in the end.
Stephen Cook, again, with the Council on Foreign Relations. Borju Daragahi, still with us. I know you're eager to go with the Financial Times, but you have been around that region a good deal. I'm just very interested in your take on all of these different developments that are occurring and what they might mean.
I think it's that's a very big question, Warren. But
it is a huge question. 30 seconds to answer it.
But what I would say is that I think one of the most intriguing things that's emerging is a sort of prototypical Muslim Democrat, quote unquote, that is linked to the Brotherhood, backed by Qatar, promoted by Al Jazeera, supported by the moderate Islamists in Turkey. And you see this kind of prototype emerging in Tunisia, where the Nahda party emerged, the victorious party that's rooted in the Muslim Brotherhood of Tunisia. You see it in Libya, where so-called moderate Islamists are emerging after Gaddafi's fall. In Morocco, as Stephen Cook was pointing out, with the emergence of a party that is modeled to some extent on Turkey's Justice and Development Party. And also in Egypt, where the Muslim Brotherhood is trying to rebrand itself as Islamists who respect and respect democratic rules and believe in tolerance and this sort of vision of Islam that is much more cosmopolitan than we in the West are used to.
Well, Borja Deragahi, that's a lovely summary, and thank you very much for doing it, and thanks for being on our program as always.
It's been a pleasure.
Again, a reporter covering North Africa and the Middle East for the Financial Times. Mona El-Tahawi, are you encouraged by what you hear from these other countries in addition to what's going on in Egypt?
I am very encouraged that what we all along had seen in the region when Tunisia started and then Egypt followed, which is this coming to light of this very, very deep-seated need to liberate ourselves from dictators has spread across the region. I mean, those of us from the region had no doubt this would happen, but there was so much naysaying that went on at the time and continues to go on. So that definitely encourages me. What doesn't encourage me is that I worry sometimes that all the Islamists in the region are looked at as the same. I mean, just listening to some of your other guests, it hurts me to hear the Muslim Brotherhood compared, for example, to a Nahda in Tunisia. Because, you know, again, for me as a feminist, it really matters where they stand on women's rights. Whereas the Nahda in Tunisia have many women in their decision-making body. The Muslim Brotherhood doesn't have one single woman in the higher echelons. 49 of the women who won seats in Tunisia's Constituent Assembly, of those 49, 42 came from the Nahda. So you have this very active women's wing in the Nahda, which cannot be said of the Muslim Brotherhood. So I think just as we cannot paint the whole region as monolithic, we also can't paint all these Islamist groups as monolithic just because they're the most organized.
Okay.
We have to be just as challenging to them as we were of dictatorship.
And finally, Stephen Cook with the Council on Foreign Relations. It's ironic in a way that the United States, after supporting these repressive regimes for so many decades, is now encouraging a democracy. It's a little early, I guess, to conclude that we should or should not be happy with the results, but we haven't had a lot of choice.
Well, that's exactly right. We don't have a choice. Arabs are writing their own history, and there is no reason for the United States to step in and make its feelings known about the outcome. We don't even know what the outcome is, and anything that the United States does to get involved will rebound poorly on the United States. The Obama administration should stick to first principles of democracy, of tolerance, of nonviolence, of accountability. And to echo what Mona El-Tahawi was just saying, and importantly, women's rights. I think that we are seeing new political forces or old political forces accumulate new power in the region, and they need to be held accountable if the United States is going to be taken seriously as in the region. And that includes the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, if it should do as well as people think it may.
Well, thank you very much. Again, Stephen Cook with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of The Struggle for Egypt from Nasser to Tahrir Square. Thanks to Mona El-Tahawi as well and all of our other guests. It's good to have all of you, and we'll keep up to date as best we can on the Arab Spring as it develops, for better or for worse. In 1987, Democrat Barty Frank of Massachusetts became the first member of Congress to publicly come out as gay. Since then, he has become a powerhouse, chairing the House Financial Services Committee when his party was in control. Today, Barney Frank announced he will not seek re-election next year. Back in a moment with To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're finally back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Here's Barney Frank today explaining that a newly redrawn congressional district, it was reapportionment that led him to announce his retirement plans after more than 30 years in Congress.
If I were to run again, I would be engaged full-fledged in a campaign, which is entirely appropriate. Nobody ought to expect to get elected without a contest. But the fact that it is so new makes it harder in terms of learning about new areas, introducing myself to new people.
Barney Frank, once again, announcing his retirement or his decision not to run for re-election next year. Susan Milligan writes about politics and foreign affairs for U.S. News and World Report. It's good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be back. Thanks so much for having me.
It's going to be a strange and different place without Barney Frank and his voice and his very tough attitude toward all kinds of things.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and in so many ways, I mean, one thing, he is probably the smartest person in the House of Representatives, and people who disagree with him vehemently on the Hill would tell you that. Really is just brilliant. He's bitingly funny. He's actually one of the last smart alecks in Congress. I've really been disappointed at how we've lost. We don't have any smart alecks in the Senate anymore since we lost Alan Simpson. That's pretty much a boring place now, but Barney was always a great source of humor on the House side as well. And, you know, just people forget just how big a deal it is, you know, to have someone who's openly gay in the role that he was. And I think when things really turned on the Hill for the gay members was when Barney became chairman of financial services, because up until then, despite what he'd done, he'd been ranking member, he'd done all this stuff, people sort of always kind of identified him as, oh, the gay congressman. And once he became chairman of financial services, which was such a powerful committee, that eclipsed all of that. So it's made things easier for other members. You know, David Cicilline was elected from Rhode Island last year, a Democrat, openly gay, and it's like it's not even an issue. I mean, nobody even mentions it or brings it up, and it's because Barney kind of changed the dynamic, I think, for gay and lesbian members on the Hill. So, but he's just also just so much that he's done in housing and in financial regulation. I realize the financial service industry probably isn't that happy about it, but he was great to have around. He was probably the least, one of the least pretentious people you could meet. I mean, even when he was chairman, I mean, if you called anybody else on the Hill, some obscure subcommittee chairman, nobody cared about you. You get all this back and forth all day. Well, have the chairman call you at this time. Oh, the chairman's on the phone. Yes, I have the chairman right here. Right. With Barney, you just shoot an email to his press guy and say, hey, if he's got a few minutes today, I want to talk to him about such and such. Literally within a half an hour, your phone would ring and it would be him, and he'd just say, yeah, it's Barney. I mean, it's just no pretension whatsoever. But my favorite, because Barney really, he wasn't a big technology guy. I mean, he was not Anthony Weiner, to be sure. He was not anybody. He didn't do any of the texting and all that. He hated that stuff. Way back when everybody had cell phones, he hated the cell phone. He was always losing it. And then the battery would run out before they could call the number to find out where it was. It was driving his staff crazy. So the same thing was true with the Blackberries and the iPhone. So at one point, he and I were out to dinner. This was in 2007, and I took my Blackberry out. And the campaign had already started, so I had to check and see if my office had any questions. I said, you know, I'm really sorry. I have to, you know, see if they have any questions. And here he is, chairman of financial services, one of the most powerful people on the Hill. And he says, I don't have one of those. My staff wants me to get one. They said I need it in case of an emergency. What emergency? I don't know CPR, and I can't make bail. I'm no good at an emergency. I'm like, okay, you know, maybe they might need to send you something, Barney. But so he was just, you know, he's just been so great to have around. He'd sit there at the table in the speaker's lobby and doing the New York Times crossword puzzle in ink, you know. so, yeah, we're really going to miss having him around.
I should have told our listeners that before he went with the U.S. News and World Report, he worked for a long time for the Boston Globe, and right. You spent a lot of time with Barney.
Oh, yeah,
Barney
a lot of
Frank.
Time with him.
He did get some laughs today talking about Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, he thinks it'll be the best thing to happen to the Democrats, I think, if Newt gets the nomination, and which may be true, although Kane might be better for the Democrats. He's got a real edge, and I think I think what it is that look, several years ago, believe it or not, he told me he wasn't going to run in 2012, and I wasn't sure how seriously to take it because it was 3 years out. And he said, look, I want to write books, and I'm an easy writer, I'm an easy talker, but I'm not an easy writer. And, you know, and his Jim, his boyfriend, you know, never sees him, and they wanted to spend more time together. Well, and then earlier this year, he said he was going to run. I'm like, maybe he doesn't want to go out in the minority. But now I think he's right. With the district, he doesn't really like campaigning. Some people love campaigning and don't particularly like legislating. Barney loves legislating, but he doesn't like the fundraising and all the stuff that you have to go through to keep your job. Frankly, you see a lot of members now who have just gotten to the point where they're spending more time trying to keep their jobs than doing their jobs, and they just can't stand it anymore.
There are now 17 Democrats who've announced that they won't run for re-election. Does it appear that any of them think that the Democrats aren't going to take the majority again next year and they just want to get out of there?
I think that that's the case. I think that they're not optimistic, but I think they've got a shot, and I think they do have a shot. Actually, it's too hard to tell right now. Anybody who tries to predict next year's elections is just silly. I mean, you know, look at how quickly things changed in 2010. A lot can happen. I don't think it's so much that as that they're just so exhausted, physically, mentally, emotionally, at just, you know, what they have to go through to keep a job where they just can't even get things done anymore. I mean, look what happened with the super committee. People are really, you know, I know that everybody loves to, you know, everybody beats up on Congress. And as you know, I love Congress. I realize it's not a very popular position right now, but I deeply admire the commitment they make. And, you know, they disagree, and, you know, I might personally disagree with some of them, but they've made an extraordinary commitment. And they go in there and they think, I've got to spend all my time raising money, going back and forth all the time to come up here where, you know, we're at a stalemate all the time. They don't think they're, you know, they don't see their families. They're physically exhausted. And I think if they felt they were getting something done, they'd do it.
Susan Milligan, that's all the time we have again with U.S. News and World Report. Thanks so much. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Sonia Geis and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.